And welcome back to Coast, where we will take your phone calls now this hour as we talk about the runaway species. It's a fantastic discussion about creativity in the brain. Dr. David Eagleman and Anthony Brandt with us, and we'll get you involved when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. David Eagleman with us, Tony Brandt with us. Tony, what was your first instrument and how old were you when you started playing?
Violin, and I was 6 years old.
And that's what did it for you, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. I give my parents a lot of credit. They didn't buy my sister or I any prefabricated toys. They only bought us like construction toys and crayons and paper and stuff like that. So whenever we really wanted something, we had to make it ourselves. And so, you know, I loved music from the minute I started playing the violin. And so it just naturally meant that I should try composing it too.
Well, that's great. And did you pick up on the violin quickly?
You know, reasonably quickly. It's an instrument that's very demanding because if you don't practice, you don't sound very good after a while. And at least if you play the piano, it's always in tune, whether you've worked for the last 6 months or not. But if you don't work on the violin all the time, you play out of tune. So eventually I had to choose between composing and violin, and I chose composing.
And how would you, Tony, equate creativity with the power of the brain?
Well,
with music.
You know, I just think that it's one of the most satisfying things anybody can do. I feel very blessed to be able to do something that I love so much, but I also think that it just connects you to every other person on the planet because, you know, as we've been talking about with you the last hour, and it's been so much fun, it's just something that's going on in brains all the time. And to be able to, you know, take something you're dreaming about inside of your head and put it in a form that you can share it with other people is really rewarding.
And David, you know, as a neuroscientist, there are a lot of people who don't come up with the better mousetrap or anything like that. Yet they're probably creative in their day-to-day living, aren't they?
Well, maybe they are, maybe they're not. You know, everything that we do requires a lot of creativity. So when you're deciding what you're going to eat and you have to put things together from the refrigerator, or what you're deciding what you're going to say next to your spouse, or whether you're coming up with a great new scientific idea or doing a new painting, these are all actually the same brain process going on about taking everything that's been stored in there and remixing it and smashing it up and coming out with new versions of things. So there's a sense in which we are all, you know, creative all the time. But, you know, what's interesting is that most of the ideas that we generate are not terribly good ideas. In other words, you know, when I'm thinking about how to solve a problem, or Tony is thinking about, you know, writing a new piece of music, much of what we come up with is, okay, well, what if we did that? No, that's not going to work. What if we did that? No, that's not going to work either. And so a big part of creativity actually is filtering, is figuring out, okay, I can generate lots of options, but how do I know which ones to keep and pursue versus which ones to just toss out? And this speaks to the importance of proliferating options, of just coming up with lots of things. And when you look around in different companies or different artists and so on, what you find behind the scenes is that they generate lots of different versions of whatever they're trying to come up with before the thing that you see publicly. And, of course, it's the same thing that happens in science, too. Everyone's lab notebook is full of a million stupid ideas that didn't happen to work out before you hit the eureka.
What would you like people to grasp when they read The Runaway Species?
Oh, Tony, did you want to?
Yeah, that creativity is part of the software of every human brain, and we need to cultivate it in every child.
And is it easy or difficult to do that with a child?
Oh, it's easy. I mean,
they're very adaptable, aren't they?
They are, and, you know, every child on the planet, given the opportunity, plays. It's just a universal part of development. And so, you know, that part of their creativity is totally manifest, and any new parent is going to see that. The hard part is once they get into school, and to some extent, you know, that gets shunted to the side. You know, right now, too often, we're trying to get kids to grow up into adults as fast as possible. And, you know, we feel like it would be actually nice to sustain them as children as long as possible in the sense of their open-mindedness and their speculation and their constant generation of new possibilities.
Well, and you're right. The schools really do not push or foster creativity or anything like that, do they? I don't think they really understand innovation.
And yet, the world outside that we're raising our children to live in is constantly clamoring for it. I mean, there's article upon article about businesses and, you know, institutions everywhere saying we need more innovators. We need people who are capable of coming up with the next great ideas. And yet our schools seem too often pointed in the opposite direction. And there are good reasons, and there are legitimate reasons for some of the strategies that schools take. And David and I would never say that it's an either-or proposition, that everything has to change. But there's so many easy ways for teachers not to have to rewrite their, you know, their lesson plans and tear up their textbooks, but actually just to build more creativity into the way that the kids learn.
You know, when you sometimes you look at a CEO, a man or a woman, you can generally predict their personalities and things like that. Now, with somebody who's clever and creative, do they possess certain personality traits?
And we would say absolutely not in any way that's easy to identify. In fact, you know, you just look at history, how, you know, iffy our track record is in predicting who the lasting achievements are going to be made by. You know, there's so many stories of great artists who were overlooked in their own lifetime and great scientists who were overlooked. And so that's with adults, where they even have a track record and there's a sense of they have a professional career. When you're talking about kids, the younger they are, the harder it is to predict, you know, who's going to turn out to be the most creatively gifted and able.
All right, let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going to Susan in Victoria, British Columbia, west of the Rockies. Hello, Susan. Good morning.
Good morning. I have decades of experience as a physicist and a computer scientist, and basically I was hired to solve problems as a tool and die maker. I'd go in and they'd give me a problem and say, come back when it's solved, and it didn't matter whether it was DARPA or education or brain research, which the last one I was working in magnetoencephalography, which one of your guests will recognize. And the biggest thing that shocked me the most when I was working in brain research, and I had my own brain trauma, which was related to last night's lecture on what happens after you come out of those things, all the gifts you get, is the eureka moments. Because the aeronautical engineer I worked for 3 years while I was a student in physics, he came in one morning and he said, throw out all the work I've paid you for the last 3 years. And I went, excuse me? He had slept on the problem and come up with an entirely different way of doing it mathematically, wrote it down, got out of bed, wrote it down and brought it into work and said, let's go with this new method, and it worked. And that was in about 1973. And then I had this severe brain trauma. I'd gone back to university to do artificial intelligence and factory robotics after all my other work in image processing. And I had a severe brain trauma during surgery, and I came out of that with all these gifts that I'd never had before. And I did have some beforehand that I didn't know about. And I can do a whole problem. It's really common for me, and even when I was working in the first 25 years, to come out in the morning with the answer for something I could have been working on for like 12 years with a new way, and I got the whole answer just like that first boss did. And you can't see that on brain scans. None of that's visible. Brain scans show you the predictable behavior, like if I want to put a paraplegic with an artificial arm and get his brain to move such and such a finger now, he can do it through the brain studies that I saw with that magnetoencephalography. And that uses quantum physics. And I was doing that work in 2001. And now I'm back to work I did for 12 years in the environmental sciences, because I still find that super stimulating. And the guys I'm working with in research are in their 60s and 70s, and we're still as keen as ever. And I look back on all the ways that we learn, and we have at least 6 ways of learning. In my case, it turned out after the brain trauma, I'd been a preemie, so I'd had a underlying dyslexia all my life, not diagnosed, and color blindness. So I gravitated to hands-on labs, and I just skyrocketed with, I had perfect memory, perfect hearing, but I had problems doing the reading and the writing, and yet I could do it on handwork. That's where my career ended up, not knowing that till late in life. Then I got into dowsing and alternative energy healing because of the brain trauma. And if we're going to survive on this planet, creativity is those intuitive gifts that you can't force it. It's everything's percolating, and I look at it like a computer system where my foreground is doing the cooking, but my background is busy processing the problem 24 hours a day, whether I like it or not, and all of a sudden the answer comes up.
That's an interesting take of that. How many of these people who are creative, David, have you found to be somewhat psychically inclined or have that kind of ability? Any of them?
good question. Creativity, as Tony pointed out earlier, this is just part of what brains do. Brains take in the world, they smush it up and come up with different versions of it. To be creative does not actually require anything which you called psychically inclined or something like that. It's just not a required part of what happens. Instead, it's happening in every brain all the time.
Next up, we go to Todd in Birmingham, Alabama. Welcome to the show, Todd. Good to have you with us.
Hey guys, man, this just blew me away. I just relocated here. I actually grew up in Mississippi, but I've been fortunate enough in my life to travel around. I went to school in Tuscany in college.
Uh-huh.
And just, I mean, I went through school, you know, as an art major and painting and drawing, you know, and I taught in the high schools and things. Everything you're talking about is just, I mean, it's just hitting on all cylinders with me. It's just great. It's great to hear this. The world we live in now is so small in ways that, you know, we can just put everything on the screen and see it there. But at the same time, that experience of being able to be in that location and see those things and experience it firsthand enhances the creativity at a level that is unbelievable. I mean, that's the draw that's gone through history. You have artists and you have musicians and you have writers who've all been drawn to locations.
I wonder why, though, some people are sharper, Tony, than others in terms of creativeness. How come?
Well, you know, there's a variety of things, including there's a lot of folks who will come up to us and say, well, you know, I'm not creative. And you'll ask them, so, well, why would you say that? And they'll often say, somebody told me that when I was young. You know, they compared me with my sibling, or they compared me with other people in the class. And, you know, that's really wrong. You really don't know until you've tried it. And another thing is that motivation is really important. I mean, creativity is not sort of an ad hominem thing where, you know, you necessarily, like, want to be creative about how you unlock your front door. And there are areas in all of our lives where we'd actually rather have habits and routines. But there are those special things where, you know, we feel a passion and we feel a spark. And if you can connect to that, and instead of using ready-mades, take it as a challenge to come up with your own ways of doing things, and each time make it different, I think all of us would find we have some amazing creative resources.
Yeah, I think you're right, too. Let's take another call or two before the break and come back with final calls. Joe in the Bronx. Hey, Joe, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
Wonderful, thanks.
Good, good. Yeah, now I wanted to ask your guest now, do you think the brain is cognizant that at that moment in the process of creativity, that it is being creative? And also, second question, with quirks of the brain like OCD, etc., is the brain capable of fixing itself, of healing itself of those disorders?
Both good questions. So in answer to the first question, it turns out that almost everything the brain does, you're not consciously aware of. In other words, what's happening under the hood is vast operations that you only, if you're lucky, get to, you know, hear the final result of. So in my book Incognito, I describe the conscious mind as the broom closet in the mansion of the brain. So it answered a question of, is the brain aware when it's being creative? Almost always no, because all of the inputs that it's taking in, it's mashing those up under the hood. And occasionally, some of those mashups will make it to the surface of consciousness, and you know, only the ones that sort of have a chance of making sense will make it up there. But of course, even among those, some of them, many of them, won't make much sense. So that's the first question. The second question, I'm so sorry, I'm afraid I already forgot what the second thing was. What was the second question?
OCD.
Like, can the brain heal itself?
Oh, can the brain heal itself? Well, the interesting part is that the brain operates like a team of rivals, which is to say you've got all these different drives in your brain happening all the time. So just as an example, if I put some warm chocolate chip cookies in front of you, part of your brain wants to eat that because it's a rich energy source. Part of your brain says, don't eat it, you're going to get fat. Part of your brain says, okay, I'll eat it, but I'll promise my spouse that I'll work out tomorrow, and so on. And you can argue with yourself, you can cuss at yourself, you can cajole yourself, and you know, who's talking with whom here? The answer is, you're made up of all these different neural networks that are all battling to steer the ship of state. So the right way to think about the brain is it's like a neural parliament with these different political parties, all of whom love their country, but they just have very different ways of steering things. And so the sense in which the brain can heal itself or help itself is just that sometimes you can tip one of these parties into having a majority vote. So, you know, you can say, all right, let's say you're a chocolate chip cookie addict. You can say, look, here are all the reasons why I want to not give in to that part of my brain when I get these temptations. And you can set up structures in your life so that you'll do the right thing and so on. And this is the sense in which the brain is healing itself, because you've just got these different drives. And so, you know, this is what we often summarize as willpower and things like that, but it's a way of steering yourself into the right place. And when it comes to OCD, it would be something like part of your brain really wants to wash your hands over and over and over, or turn the doorknob several times, and you know, whatever the thing is, you have other parts of your brain that say, okay, look, here are all the reasons why I shouldn't do that.
I had a guy once on my local talk show in St. Louis, David and Tony, called me one day and said that he belonged to a chronic disorder club, a very compulsive chronic disorder club. And I said, oh, really? How did you get into it? And then, you know, he said, well, we're very compulsive about everything. And I said, well, when do you get together? He said, every day. Every day. I want to get your reaction when we come back from the break about the disease of repetitive brain trauma, CTE. It kills brain cells, and why the brain doesn't regenerate. So think about that. We're going to come back in a moment and take final phone calls with our two special guests. Their book is available everywhere. It's called The Runaway Species, How Human Creativity Remakes the World. You should read at least one book a week, at least, just for yourself. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Dr. David Eagleman and Tony Brandt, as we talk about their work, The Runaway Species. David, this is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, ECTE, if I pronounce that thing right, kills off brain cells. Lots of football players, athletes have this from repetitive brain trauma. Why doesn't the brain regenerate itself? I always thought it did.
No, the brain does not regenerate itself. You're born with a certain number of brain cells, and then it's all downhill from there.
That's real. I always thought that was a myth.
Oh, no, that's the real thing. That's That's, there are many cells in your body, many organs in your body where the cells are constantly dividing and so on, but not so with the brain. You get to, now there's a tiny bit that was discovered. There's a tiny bit of what's called neurogenesis where you have the birth of some new brain cells, but it's a vanishingly small amount. And so, essentially all you're doing in life is losing brain cells. Now it doesn't much matter for most of your life. But when it matters is if you have repeated concussions, for example, you're really damaging parts of your brain. And those cells will never come back.
Jeez. When you drink heavily, does that kill brain cells? They used to say stuff like that.
Yeah, that also kills brain cells. Hitting your head on the cabinet when you stand up or any of that stuff.
Jeez.
Kills brain cells. Like I said, most of the time it doesn't make too much of a difference in your life.
What about stem cells? What if you had stem cells injected into your head?
Yeah, it's a good question, and a lot of scientists have been very interested in this for a while, but the danger there is we don't actually know how to control their growth, and so the concern is you inject stem cells somewhere and then you get a cancerous tumor, as in it keeps proliferating and dividing and dividing.
Right.
Yeah. So far the treatment of using stem cells hasn't been safe enough to do in humans.
Let's go back to the phones. Buck in Limestone, West Virginia. Hello, Bucky Nam. Go ahead.
Hey, George, it's a pleasure speaking with you again.
Good to have you on.
Well, thank you. If I may, I would like to ask the doctor, by the way, fascinating show this evening.
Thank you, sir.
But anyway, I've always been particularly fascinated with the concept of deja vu. And I'm wondering if the doctor, it would be possible for him to explain as in lay terms as possible what actually is going on in the brain, when we experience deja vu.
All right. Can you address that, David?
Yeah, sure. It's that we're always trying to do template matching, as in, oh, this is my home. I've seen this before. Here's my neighbor walking his dog. I've seen this before.
I know what they're going to say when you walk into a meeting. It just hits you that way.
Well, sorry, I'm not talking about deja vu yet. I'm just talking about what we normally do, which is we're always template matching, which is we're saying, okay, look, I just walked into this building. Is this a building I have seen before?
Right.
This is what the brain's doing normally. The thing is that sometimes we do it inappropriately, as in there's a mistake, and you match something, and you think, oh, I've been in a situation like this before where somebody says something, and then somebody puts their plate down, and then somebody blah, blah, blah. You inappropriately matched that template before, and you believe that you have been in that situation before, even though you haven't. It's an erroneous match. Now, obviously, some people believe that deja vu is actually something about, seeing, having seen the future or seeing the future and you know what's going to happen next. But it's easy to, the next time your friend says, whoa, I'm having deja vu, I feel like I've been here before, take out $20 and say, I will give this to you if you can tell me what happens next. And you'll never actually lose your $20 because they can't actually tell you what happens next. Instead, it's just a feeling.
And if they do, you just don't do it that way.
That's right. But, then you run away. Maybe your friend knew that you were going to do that. But the this is how you can prove to yourself that deja vu isn't actually that you have seen the future, but instead it's an erroneous match. In the same way that sometimes you might look at somebody's face walking down the street and you think, God, I feel like I know that person, but it's because your unconscious brain is matching someone else's face to their face.
Tony, with music, why is it that the brain loves some music and it doesn't like others? And people have different tastes, of course. We all do. But music is different for a lot of people. I mean, we don't have the old symphonies of Mozart anymore or things like that. So music changes.
Oh, for sure.
But
yeah.
Why is it, music is pleasant to some, mm-hmm. emotional, and to others, it's loud racket and noise?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, great question. So for one thing, we're all vessels of our time and place. And what we're exposed to is what we get used to. And there are scientific studies that show that familiarity, just being exposed to something over and over again, makes you appreciate it and admire it more. And so a lot of this just has to do with what we're immersed in. What's really incredible is the diversity of music across world cultures and how different, for instance, Western traditional music is from the music of the Far East and Africa, and how human imagination has really taken the whole concept of musical self-expression in so many different directions. And yet, when you're in a particular culture, that's the norm to you. That's what moves you. That's what inspires you.
Next up, we've got Monty in Grass Valley, California with us, west of the Rockies. Monty, go ahead.
Yeah, I think we're sort of entering into a tender trap, which I sort of call little screens for little minds. For instance, you go to somewhere like Peking, you look up, you don't even know the sky is blue. A lot of people don't even know there are stars. Talking about GPS, for instance, they can't find north, south, east, or west, or read a map. And maps are actually really important, you know. And we have, and I could go on with a thousand other things,
sure,
too. So I'd like to hear a comment from your guest.
Okay, let's go with you first on that, David. And, you know, that would also include, for example, you ask someone of a younger age to do some quick subtraction without a calculator in their hands, they can't do it.
Yeah, I happen to be a real cyber optimist on this point. I think that there's so much that we did in our generation growing up, you know, X number of decades ago, that we feel nostalgic about, and we're, you know, we feel that if kids can't memorize phone numbers or do subtraction in their heads, they must have lost something in the process. But in fact, memorizing a phone number or doing subtraction in your head is a trivial, silly task that doesn't actually do anything for us as humans or do anything for humanity. And so instead, you know, kids nowadays are growing up having the whole planet as their playground in terms of what they can access and understand, and not only the planet, but everything at very small scales and large scales that can pull up an iPad and get to surf around inside an atom or surf around the solar system. And that is unbelievably useful for giving them ideas that'll cause real creativity. Whereas doing subtracting or phone numbers is quite limited in what it can lead to.
Henry's turn, North Hollywood, California. Henry, go ahead, sir.
Well, I wanted to just point out that geosynchronous satellites are stuff like communication satellites and not the GPS, just as a little quickie. Because I wanted to also talk about how you were mentioning the Chinese music and mode of thought. How the Chinese are putting up quantum satellites, and I was wondering if you knew if these possibly use the new diamond spin transistors, if these are things that maybe were on the breakthrough of the mind machine link, maybe, you know, that they seem to be, whatever it is that they're doing with their thoughts, are radically different from whatever we're following.
What do these diamond transistors do, Henry?
Well, they have a vacancy of nitrogen with them, and I believe one of the first callers was talking about the magnetic field properties,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'd have to just sit through like four or five web pages where I'm basically reading these things off, but it's that things are entangled. I spin electron, they're saying 1,243-mile quantum link between Shanghai and Beijing. And that they're doing this with satellites, and that, you know, various ESP experiments that people have done before. And it just seems like the West won't really tackle these, you know, as while they're really pushing forward. Oh, and just a fun little thing, I personally believe in precognition because I, too, have suffered brain damage. I spent 30 days in confinement in the Los Angeles Twin Towers. And I basically had to fight for 30 days for my life in fisticuffs, insanity wall-to-wall fights. And the only way I survived was getting inside the heads of my opponent and knowing how to hit their nerves, when to sabotage their moves.
Why did you do that? Why did you do that to them? Anyways, David, do you want to react to any of that or just move on?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the goal of science has been to try to do replicable tests and see what's going on. And scientists in general are incredibly open-minded to what is the truth of the universe. And, you know, we keep discovering things that are weirder and stranger. Now, when it comes to something like ESP, people have tried that for many decades. Duke University had this Ryan Institute or Roan Institute, I forgot what it was called, but that was open for like 20 or 30 years, where they tried all kinds of experiments about ESP, and they finally, you know, they finally ran out of funding, and the institute shut down because they couldn't find anything that was actually replicable. So what the guests first started to say about quantum entanglement, it is true that you can entangle two quantum particles and send them far away from each other, and then you measure the state of one, and that instantly changes the other. But that's science. I mean, that's the kind of thing we can measure. As far as ESP goes, there doesn't, unfortunately, appear to be any evidence supporting that. It would be a much more interesting world if there were, but there's not.
Is the one better than the many when it comes to creativity? If you had 10 people in a think tank room, would they come up with more creative things than this one person?
So creativity is incredibly social, and the myth that one person alone, separated from everyone else, is going to somehow prosper creatively, that's really not true. Whether the 10 people all need to be in the room together, that's going to differ based on the task and the characteristics of the people. But if you want to capture the idea that essentially we're social beings and bouncing ideas off of each other and taking the best of what someone else says and messing with it a little bit and tweaking it and sending it back, that captures that better than the idea of one person all by themselves. And you know, you can look through history and almost every single person who's identified as being the great solo creator, that myth melts when you look at it up close, when you actually see the details.
We've got Ian in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania now with us. Ian, go ahead. Good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, George. It's a great show so far.
Thank you, sir.
So I'm a musician, and I was practicing earlier today, actually, with my beatbox. I forced myself to sit down and practice because I do at least an hour a day.
Good for you.
I wanted to bring something up I read online while I was waiting, and I think it's meant to be that I do. There are these frequencies called solfeggio frequencies. They're from ancient tone scales. They used to be used in sacred music,
mm-hmm.
including the beautiful Gregorian chants.
Mm-hmm.
These tones were believed to have spiritual blessings when sung in harmony and comprised of a frequency required to balance your energy, keep your mind and your spirit in perfect harmony. Could you talk a little about that?
Sure. So I think that we've often attributed to different kinds of music mystical healing powers. What I would say is that that's absolutely true, but it's enculturated. So, for instance, Indian rags, the scales out of which Indian music is based, those scales are supposed to have very concrete affects on the person listening. And there are medieval treatises that describe this. But they found even that modern Indian listeners who are not familiar with that type of music, it just doesn't have that effect on them. So you really have to be part of the cultural milieu to get the full benefit of that. And we too often in the West kind of jump at the fact that we've got this wonderfully worked out system that's been true in classical music and also lives on in a lot of popular music, to think that somehow there's something absolute about it. But again, it's all cultural conditioning. And cultural conditioning is incredibly powerful. I mean, that's not to minimize that. It's what's amazing is how much when we are immersed in any musical language, how much it can move us and have an impact on us. But I don't think there's anything universal or absolute about it.
We've only got about 30 seconds left. And David, your websites and also Anthony's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. The Runaway Species, available all over the place, no doubt, right?
Yes,
that's right.
Excellent. Good luck with both of you and great information. Up next, going off the grid. I'll be talking to Gary Collins. He is an expert in going off the grid. He'll tell you all about his life, why he did this, and why you should. And also, don't forget to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and you can email me at george@coasttocoastam.com.